When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Dreadcar, and with me, as always, is Brian Catman Reese.
Oh, we couldn't have gone with Deathlock.
I thought about Deathlock.
Yeah, Darklock.
Darklock. Oh, yeah, I was thinking about maybe...
Totally different character.
I was thinking about maybe Darklighter, because that's what you light your cigarettes with. But I figured you'd be okay with Catman.
Well, Catman's a different character.
That's true. So today on the program, we will be discussing the epic space opera, Dreadstar by Jim Starlin. But first, taking a cue from Mr. Starlin, I thought it would be fun to discuss some of the media that has, let's say, took inspiration from a little film called Star Wars. Now, after the release of Star Wars and its popularity and all that, there was a rush to capitalize on this popularity by ripping off, I mean, paying homage to.
Homage. Homage.
Homage. Now, there, Brian, I'm sure you know several things that probably jump to mind that are, yeah. There are good ones, or at least things that I really like Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
The Black Hole.
Oh, right. The Black Hole. Yeah.
I think that's an underrated gem. I guess, would you call Star Trek the motion picture trying to capitalize on Star Wars?
Yes. I mean, I think that Star Wars allowed them to go back and allowed the, it said it's okay to make a sci-fi movie now.
Right.
I mean, the Star Trek fan base, I think, was always in place for a movie, but I bet they wouldn't have had the budget that they had if it were had not been for Star Wars.
Yeah.
So Star Wars allowed it, but it's certainly not like a Star Wars ripoff in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, no. It's more of a ripoff of like 2001 A Space Odyssey than Star Wars. It's very slow, that first one.
Very slow.
Yeah. I love it, by the way, but it is very slow.
I have very fond memories. It's been a long time since I saw it, but I have fond memories of it. Of course, I was too young when it came out to have any kind of critical remove.
Oh, yeah. It was a movie, therefore it was good.
Yes.
Yes.
I am going to see a movie with my dad. Yay, this is a good movie.
Anything that was on television was just good.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were other things that were released that tried to capitalize on the Star Wars phenomena, and some of them were not as good.
I'm going to disagree with you on one of those.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to say I'll reserve judgment. I won't make a decision for you whether it was good or bad. But the first one I want to start with is just a film that I think is amazing. It's not good, but it's amazing. It's called Star Crash. You have not seen this.
I have not seen Star Crash, but I did see.
I sent you the trailer for it.
I did see the trailer. And I really want to see Star Crash now.
You should really see Star Crash. It is a, if anyone out there who hasn't seen it, it's an Italian B movie. It has David Hasselhoff playing essentially Han Solo, some guy with an afro trying to be Luke Skywalker, and lots of semi-naked women running about.
Right, as one does.
As one does in an Italian movie.
Yes.
And yeah, they even have lightsabers, which is just... They're not even trying to hide.
The lack of subtlety was refreshing.
Yes. If you watch the movie, the plot makes no sense. It's just kind of faffing about until there's a fight and some effects that are questionable.
The dirty little secret, of course, is that in the original Star Wars movie, there are parts of that plot that make no sense either.
Oh, I disagree. They all
don't at me, people.
It's absolute at that film's incredibly tight. Can't cut a thing out without losing the whole. It's perfect.
Hmm.
Well, so anyway, Star Crash.
Star Crash. I don't have anything to add other than that trailer is phenomenal.
Yes. If anyone has a chance, go see Star Crash, or, you know, not go see it, but stream it somewhere on something.
That it's gotta be there somewhere, right?
Yeah. It is an experience.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
The trailer was an experience.
Yeah. The other film that I remember liking when I first saw it, but have revisited it maybe a couple of years ago, and that's Ice Pirates.
Whew.
And boy, that does not hold up. I don't think it ever held up at all.
I don't imagine it. So again, that was another film. I saw Ice Pirates. I saw it when it was in the theater. I haven't seen it probably since then. I just, my biggest takeaway from Ice Pirates as a person of a younger age, was the space herpes, which just cracked me up beyond all belief.
Well, who doesn't laugh at space herpes, really?
Space herpes. I do not like, so watching the trailer for it, I do not remember it being billed as a comedy when I went to see it.
I don't remember that either. It's
an original trailer. It feels like an original trailer.
It was. It was the original trailer. But like I said, I didn't remember it. I remembered it being funny, but I didn't remember it being wacky.
Right.
And if no one knows, this is it's a wacky screwball comedy set in space starring Spencer for Hire. Bob Ehrlich?
Robert Urich.
Right, yeah.
Robert Urich. Mary Crosby is in it.
Yes. Yeah. And it's about pirates who try to steal water.
Yeah. Because
water is scarce.
Which makes sense when you think about it. I mean, the premise is kind of, you know, it's like The Expanse, you know, which treats the scarcity of water to be a serious thing, right? I mean, it's...
I want to point out that you just compared Ice Pirates to The Expanse, which is something no one's ever done and will ever do again. So so Ice Pirates? I wouldn't recommend it, other than as an oddity of the time.
Yeah, I think I'm more interested in Star Crash now than I am in going back and watching Star Pirate or Ice Pirates.
Yes, Star Crash is great.
Star Crash.
All right, we're gonna end on the one you like, but real quick, there was a television show in the late 70s called Jason of Star Command. Now, I remember watching this as a kid and liking it. It was the episodes maybe 2-3 years ago were on, I don't know, something Netflix or Amazon One. And I thought, oh, I remember this kid. I remember this as a kid. So let me revisit these episodes and see if it's what I remember. And boy, it's bad.
This may be one of the worst. Besides the fact that the main character is Han Solo.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, they're not even trying.
Oh, absolutely, they're not trying.
He's essentially wearing the same clothes as Han Solo.
No, they're trying so hard. They didn't have lightsabers, but that's pretty much it.
I don't remember. We've seen a lot of bad crap in our lives, right, Paul? I mean, we all have. The 10 minutes that I watched of this...
was 10 minutes you'll never get back.
It really... That is... absolutely some of the worst acting and worst blocking I have seen in my life.
Okay. Well, this show was made by Filmation. Now, if you don't know, Filmation was an animation company that probably the most famous thing it did was He-Man. So it's notoriously cheap using, I mean, incredibly low budgets. They also did the Star Trek animated series.
Okay.
Which is basically the same scene over and over again.
Yeah.
So, and this is like their foray into live action, and they kind of made live action the same way they made animation, which is just incredibly cheap, to the point that 10 minutes that you said you watched, there is a robot in there, a high-tech robot called Wiki, and Wiki is literally a wind-up toy. It's just a little plastic toy, and they're talking about how high-tech it is. It's a tiny little handheld wind-up toy.
And the character that the Han Solo guy is interacting with, the alien, or the guy that invented the Wiki or whatever, And so he has all these other, like, sort of robots flying around him. And you can see the strings.
Oh, yes. I thought it was...
You know, this isn't charming like an Ed Wood film.
Yeah, I thought it was just like a mobile.
But, yeah, know. It was kind of like, a, you know, this isn't, you know, two paper plates with a string pretending to be a UFO where you can kind of just laugh at. This was just, that was, ooh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. It's not so much a low budget as no budget at all.
Yeah.
It does have James Doohan in it, who is Scotty of Star Trek fam. Star Trek keeps coming up all of a sudden.
Yeah, well, you know.
Yeah. He actually left the series to go do Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Well, see here.
So Jason of Star Command, I have to admit, I have a little nostalgic fondness for it because I do remember liking it as a kid. But yeah, I don't need to go back and watch it again.
Yeah, there are many things I liked as a kid that I think
I like to collect some, like I have, you know, all five seasons of the $6 Million Man because it's just great. And I go back to those every once in a while for fun.
Between the $6 Million Man and Knight Rider, I think they were keeping like warehouses open for, you know, every scene ends up in a warehouse with a fight scene of people being thrown against stacked boxes.
Well, yes, there's always a chain link fence to be jumped over, mm-hmm. You know, and I think they both had evil twins, as I recall.
Oh, right.
Because that was a thing.
You know who else had an evil twin? Spock in Star Trek.
That's right. Everything could be brought back to Star Trek.
And you could tell because he had a goatee.
Well, yes. Oh, David Hasselhoff.
That will come up later on in our podcast today.
Yes. Well, David Hasselhoff, his evil twin, had a goatee as well, as I recall. David Hasselhoff, who's also in Star Crash.
Only there was something to tie this all into the Waltons.
It's funny you should say that. Now, there is probably the best of this bunch that we're going to talk about. Now, I know, listeners out there, there are tons and tons of movies and TV shows and stuff.
And we do have to mention in passing, probably the greatest Star Wars, direct Star Wars inspired film is of course Spaceballs.
Well, yes, absolutely, but
that's a different, we'll just leave that there. And
yeah, that's a parody. It's something completely different. But let's get on to probably the best movie of the bunch, which is the classic Battle Beyond the Stars. Yes.
Starring John Boy and George Pappard and John Saxon and Robert Vaughn.
Robert Vaughn, that's the name I was trying to think of. And it's the only Star Wars homage that can be said to say it's based on Akira Kurosawa. Yeah, so this Battle Beyond the Stars is a Magnificent Seven kind of riff.
Right.
Which, of course, is based on Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. It's kind of fun.
Well, it's Roger Corman, right?
So yes, it is Roger Corman.
The budget is a Roger Corman budget. He may have actually gotten another 10 or 20 bucks into his budget for this.
It doesn't look bad.
It doesn't look bad for the time.
For the time. The sound effects are very pew-pew.
Yeah.
But it's not, as Roger Corman films go, this actually looks pretty decent.
And you know what? It's fun. And again, this is something I watched as a kid. I don't think do you know if it was in the theater at all? No, it had to have been in the theater.
Yes.
It wouldn't have been. I saw it on TV, I think, the first time.
I was going to say, me too. I did not see this in a theater. I saw it on television for the first time.
I think it went to TV pretty quick.
I was old enough to know that, hey, that's John Boy. Why is John Boy in space? So I was able to recognize characters.
Right.
Not to mention, it's the leader of the A-team.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about this is it obviously it's a Star Wars knock in some points, and probably John Boy is the Luke Skywalker, mm-hmm. but you know George Pappard is supposed to be the Han Solo, I think, but he really isn't anything like Han Solo.
No, he's a space cowboy.
Right.
Yeah. Way before Firefly, he was a space cowboy. It's not so much a ripoff or an homage to Star Wars, but it's more just trying to capitalize on that. It's a space adventure.
I mean, it is like Star Wars. I mean, obviously Roger Corman has an encyclopedic knowledge of film. Mm-hmm. So he knows what Star Wars is based on. So he's basing this film on Star Wars, which is based on Kurosawa, etc. So it's interesting to see Roger Corman work. It's always interesting to see Roger. Yeah. It's always been interesting to see Roger Corman films. But I think, especially as a kid, you know, it was a little different than Star Wars. Obviously, it scratched my Star Wars itch. A motion for it now, a salve. But at the same time, because Battle Beyond the Stars is tragic, you know.
Is it?
I certainly hadn't seen The Magnificent. I probably had seen because my dad loved westerns, so I'm sure I saw The Magnificent Seven before this. But well, it's because I don't think I'm giving away anything away. They all stink and die.
But yeah, that's true. You don't usually see. Things, because this was advertised towards kids,
right?
And that type of thing doesn't usually end with everyone dying.
Mm-hmm.
That's rare.
I mean, John Boy survives, right? If I remember correctly, but
you can't kill John Boy.
No,
but it is very interesting, especially for to look at Corman's career, the way he's able to analyze what's popular at the time, and then craft the best knockoff. You know, and it's not like what we see today. Like, you know, there's Pacific Rim, and then there's a company that made Atlantic Rim. That's not even trying. No, but he would actually craft a semi decent film.
Yeah,
I mean, with no budget and no time to film it.
But somehow he'd always get some actor or actress of a sort of name to show up and be in it.
No, there are tons of actors, directors, just people in the film industry that look to him and say, you know, they talk of him admiringly, the way he worked and the way he was.
There's starts there. I mean, I think Cassavetes.
Yeah.
Cassavetes or was it Sales? It was probably Sales, not Cassavetes. Cassavetes wouldn't have.
Bogdanovich worked for him, you know, and then of course, Jack Nicholson got his start very famously. Just the way he was able to take no budget and no time and still be able to craft a pretty entertaining film. Now, granted, a lot of his films are terrible, but he was able to put something together that was coherent.
A good kind of terrible as opposed to just a bad terrible.
Exactly.
And Battle Beyond, just get back to the sci-fi Star Wars analog, you know, it's the Battle Beyond the Stars is, I love that movie. I just watched it again maybe 3 or 4 years ago. Obviously, I see a lot more of the flaws now and some of the issues with it. But I still had a genuine blast watching it. And is that nostalgia a little bit? But I think that if I saw Ice Pirates again, my nostalgia would not lead me to enjoying that movie.
No. I would not recommend that one.
No.
But that's it, yeah. I mean, it's very interesting to see what's popular at a particular time and just to see all the knockoffs that come around it, you know. Because look at, today we're going to see so many superhero movies that are, you know, of lesser quality. You know, and the same way it was Westerns. Everyone made a Western back in the day of varying quality.
Well, and I think Star Wars in particular, there's a reason we're doing Star Wars and obviously we're doing Dread Star later, which will... What is interesting about Star Wars is its time as, and I was thinking about this when you mentioned, hey, for the topic today, let's talk about this. And as I was trying to think about films that were influenced by Star Wars, it occurred to me that the lifespan of Star Wars as an influential film was actually very limited because once Blade Runner came out, I think that if you look at film sci-fi since Blade Runner, I think there are more films, and I don't mean to go, we don't have to talk about Blade Runner right now, but I think it's interesting. Most of the sci-fi films I see now owe a larger debt to Blade Runner than they do Star Wars.
You mean the actual look to it? It's not, rather than having the sci-fi adventure fantasy.
Right. But the look and feel of those films.
Yeah, the techno-punk kind of feel.
Right. And I feel like that legacy has endured in some ways longer than the Star Wars legacy. Again, that could be argued, and people who know film better than I do,
I would agree with you up to a point. So I do think that Blade Runner and had a huge influence, especially just the look and feel of sci-fi, mm-hmm. all through the 90s, definitely. But if you look at now, Star Wars is having, yet another renaissance. It's really from series and books and comics and, mm-hmm. it's really starting to just have a second wave, or a third wave, maybe.
Right.
You could call the prequels a second wave. Yeah, so I think, I think we're going to see some more, rollicking adventures as far as sci-fi is concerned in the near future. But I could be wrong.
We will see.
But that's it, I think. It's it was a very interesting time to be a science fiction fan.
Yeah, and particularly as kids of a certain age, too, I think.
Yeah.
That's where we grew up. That's when we were.
People of a certain age.
People of a certain age. which we are now people of a certain age.
Yes.
Some of us more recently than others.
I know. I just celebrated a birthday.
Yes.
Yes. I'm not just old. I'm older. On that note, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about a rollicking space adventure.
Woohoo!
And we're back. Brian!
Oh,
this time around, it's your choice.
Tis.
Tell us all about it.
All right, Paul. In 1982, Marvel Comics launched Epic Comics, a direct sale mature readers imprint that would seek to publish a line of comics outside of continuity, one that would allow for creators to have a broader range of creativity without the onus of the dreaded comics code. Brainchild allegedly of Jim Shooter, with the legendary Archie Goodwin as the prime mover, it would stand as the flag bearer for innovative comics being pushed by the big machine of Marvel. Epic was responsible for such titles as Six for Sirius, Moonshadow, Alien Legion, Starstruck, Coyote, Void Indigo, and many others. It was Vertigo before Vertigo. The flagship title to kick Epic off was Dreadstar, written and illustrated by Jim Starlin. Starlin, of course, is most known for his in-continuity creations Thanos, Drax the Destroyer, Shang-Chi, and a host of other characters. His primary interest in work has been in the broad cosmic space adventures, and Dreadstar is no exception. This particular run of comics comes on the tail of stories created for Epic Illustrated and a graphic novel, The Price, which was originally published by Eclipse Comics. But the series for Epic served as a proper introduction on its own, with running origin pieces mixed into the individual issues. Dreadstar follows the adventures of the hooded and magical sword-wielding hero Vanth Dreadstar and his merry band of space rebels as they fight against the forces of cosmic tyranny in the form of the Monarchy and the Instrumentality, two forces who have waged a galaxy-wide war against each other for centuries. Neither side represents the concept of good, so it is left to Dreadstar and gang to take the plight of rebellion and speak their truth to power, as it were. Dreadstar's merry band consists of the Catman Odie, blind telepath Willow, mystical wizard Darklock, and former smuggler Skeevo. High space adventure awaits as they battle through politics and despots, Darth Vader analogs, and two-ton aliens. Betrayals, laser gun battles, robots, and massive spaceships all serve to stand in the way of the freedom our heroes wish to achieve for their beleaguered universe. And can a new Christ figure prove to be the key to toppling the forces of universal darkness? only time and Vanth Dreadstar can say for sure.
You made that sound so exciting.
It is exciting.
It is exciting. You're right. So, would you like my...
I'm done. What'd you think? Not of the intro, but of the comic.
Well, I enjoyed the intro, but the comic, I enjoyed this comic. There are flaws, which we will get into, but overall, it's just Jim Starlin just has a way about him, doesn't he?
He sure does.
Yes. So the thing about Jim Starlin, I think, the thing he does so well is world building. And he creates all these intricate mythos. Yeah, and he's drawing from all kinds of ideas.
Right.
You know, obviously there's some Star Wars in here. Obviously there's some Lord of the Rings. And just, it's just basically, you can kind of see what Jim Starlin's into at the time. Right. Because he's putting it all into his comic book.
And there's obviously some Robin Hood going on as well.
Oh yeah, Robin Hood. Absolutely. Yes. But there are some truly great ideas in this. You know, an empire built around a religion that worships 12 gods that are really extra-dimensional super beings that bestow magical powers on the Pope. That's a great idea.
The Lord High People.
The Lord High People, who's definitely not a white Thanos.
No, not remotely.
No. Totally different head.
And Starlin certainly doesn't recycle the same costumes over and over and over again throughout his career.
If it works, not broke, don't fix it. He doesn't recycle it over and over. Dreadstar has a hood.
Right. isn't Darklock's costume basically used in every comic that Jim Starlin does?
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially Adam Warlock.
Yeah.
With kind of a skull face. You know what? More power to him. I'm fine.
Yeah.
If someone said, hey, I'm going to draw Adam Warlock with a skull face, go for it. Do that. Now... You know, I said his world building is really good, and he knows how to weave an intricate mythos.
Yes.
His exposition of said world building is a bit clunky.
Goes on a bit.
Yes. A bit wordy.
But, you know, we are talking Marvel here, and even it's actually less wordy than some other examples.
It's less wordy than the 1960s, for sure. But... You know, his naming conventions are a bit on the nose, but his concepts are really good, I think. Oh, wait, naming conventions. Skivo, really?
Skivo, right. Odie. I mean, I love the fact that it's not Odie the dog, right, no, from Garfield, because it's spelled O-E-D-I.
Yeah, totally different thing. And it's a cat.
It's a cat man.
Yeah, it's a cat man.
It's a man-cat hybrid.
Yeah. See, now that's a great idea as well, I think. They tried to create a race of warriors of cat hybrids, but turns out they just wanted to be farmers. That's a great idea.
Right. Yeah. And then they just wanted to lay about and lick themselves all day.
That's right. It's what you do.
It is.
Yes. Don't create a warrior race out of people who like to sleep for 20 hours a day.
Speaking of people, I do want to point out... like, I love the fact that throughout this comic, and we're reading the first 12 issues. I didn't clarify that in the intro, but we're reading the first 12 issues, which are collected in, I don't remember what the collection's called. It is a collected edition of 12 issues, the first 12 issues of the Dreadstar series proper.
It's called Volume 1.
Volume 1. Everybody is referred to as a human. throughout all the aliens are humans.
Even though they're quite obviously not humans.
Right.
Yeah. There's even that one little squid guy who keeps popping up everywhere.
Right.
Yeah. You'll see it. I'm sure it's a different character, and it's racist of me to say they all look alike. But the the little squid person, there's always one who'll just show up in every scene.
Yes.
So it's like Starlin just said, we need an alien. I'll just do the squid guy.
Do the squid guy.
But he's a human.
Why do you hate squid guys, Paul?
I know. I gotta check myself.
Check yourself. Get alien woke.
I need to. But Brian, lead the way. tell us what happened in this story.
Well, so I think like as we said in the last podcast, when I was recommending this, I hadn't read it since it came out. And I remember when Epic first launched and I was like, oh, this is really exciting, you know? And I was like, oh, and I'm wondering, you know, after I like look back at Epic and I was like, oh, Six for Sirius. I love that comic and numerous other ones. But like, I hadn't read this, I think, since I think I still have those issues somewhere in a long box. Cause as I'm reading through this and I was like, I remember that cover. I remember that cover. I remember that cover. So it's, so I hadn't read it since that time. And so it's kind of fun to recommend stuff that I haven't read recently. It's a very fun comic of its time. It's interesting to see how they are making it a mature readers. Of course, this is 1982. So mature readers mean I think they said shit a couple times. And there's a couple buts.
Yeah, there's some sexual innuendo and the thing that happens with Willow. But
yeah,
which, you know,
is a mature theme that's clunky, but we can get to that later. So essentially, you know, speaking of Battle Beyond the Stars and the Seven Samurai and whatever, I mean, it's you know, Vance Dread Star, Vance,
jeez.
I think I just want to call him Vance now.
Vance is his brother. That's his twin brother who never amounted to anything.
Vance and Vance. He's an alien. He's from somewhere. We don't know. We find out later in the series.
Right.
But, you know, he shows up on Odie's world, Odie the Catman's world, out of nowhere. And they become fast friends, right? And yeah. Vanth Dreadstar has superhuman strength and a magic sword that he produces that is hidden and sometimes he pulls out.
Yes. It's kind of a goofy looking sword, if you.
Yeah, I don't know if it's anatomically correct, but
that's not what I meant.
It's kind of a short sword. You expected him to have a longer sword, right?
But it's powerful. It's about the power of the sword, not about its length.
Right. It's the strength of the sword, and not you know. Yeah. So, to Starlet's credit, it doesn't waste a lot of time establishing things. Like in the first issue, you know, we go from introducing all the characters or semi-introducing most of the characters to, you know, basically a heist, you know, and then we jump right into it. We get some early history and then we just, you know, jump right into it where they are going. So the first three issues are heist issues.
Yes. They're basically, you know, he's gotten his team together. Now he needs funding for that team.
Right. So like in the first issue, we get like a whole bunch of introduction and then boom, we're introduced to the monarchy and the instrumentality are these two cosmic powers that have been battling each other over some forgotten planet for 200 plus years. They're basically ruling this whole galaxy in a never ending battle. And so Dreadstar and his merry band are rebelling against all this. So, you know, just start off with, they're like, well, we need money. So even in the very first issue, boom, they're like, they go and raid this floating treasury. So apparently the instrumentality, which is the religious organization, they're ruling by religious fear, which doesn't sound at all familiar to real life. And of course, because they're a church, they have lots and lots and lots of money. And so they have these floating sort of satellites where they keep all their riches. And so right off the bat, you know, we have Dreadstar and company doing a heist where they're going to like steal all the money from this one orbiting satellite. There's many of them out there, but they just picked one. And so, you know, they just go in and they get their money.
Which is a neat way to say it for Starlin, to say, you know, this is how they fund everything.
Right. And it's also a way for him to kind of introduce each individual's powers.
Right.
Each of the characters gets a turn to show off what they do, how they fit within the team dynamic.
Well, it is I thought it was interesting. The first issue, you know, they introduce Odie the Catman. They introduce Syzygy and of course, Dreadstar. And at the very end, they're like, oh, and Willow's here too. We'll tell you about her later.
We'll tell you about her.
Which they do, which he pays off. But yeah. I just always thought that was funny. It was like, oh yeah, she's here too.
Yeah. And then there's the chick for the, you know, yeah. who looks suspiciously like Scarlet from G.I. Joe.
It could be the same person, you know, parallel universe.
It might be the same person. It's the same colors on the uniform.
Okay, wait. Willow had dark hair, but dyed it red.
Blonde hair, and then changed her hair color.
Right.
Because, wait for it, she looked too much like Vanth Dreadstar's former wife.
Yeah.
With the blonde hair, so she dyed her hair red. This is in the comic.
Yes. Well, this causes some emotional distress later on, but you know what? There are some problematic issues with Willow. However, for the time, she is very empowered and is kind of a badass.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm willing to overlook some of the, let's say, cliched aspects of her.
Right.
Because Starlet's trying.
And we get her origin in the second issue. So it's like, yes, they kind of briefly introduced her in the first issue and said, we'll talk about it later. But then we get to the second issue and we get her origin story and sort of find out how she came to be a blind telepath.
And she gets a nice little moment where she kicks some ass. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without the boys being around. So
yeah,
she's good. I've seen female characters at this time treated poorly, much more poorly than Willow is. So we'll leave it at that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, without going issue by issue, although I have notes for each issue, of course, but essentially each issue that the series is episodic, it's serialized, you know, I mean, it's each issue follows up on each other, but most of the issues are at least the adventure portion of it is one and done.
You right. know,
they set out to do a thing, they do the thing. Now that leads to other things happening, but there's not a lot of cliffhangers in the way that we think of a lot of comics now where, you know, it's...
Right. I mean, there's an overarching arc, but yeah, but it doesn't, it's not Bendis-like where it kind of one comic leads into another. It's a, you know, it's a standalone story for the most part.
And, you know, each episode kind of, I mean, essentially these 12 issues are just Dreadstar and his gang's battle against mostly the instrumentality.
Yeah.
Who are kind of presented eventually as the real big bad. The monarchy is a little sketchier in terms of as the lesser of two evils.
Right. That being said, there is some... There is a Darth Vader type in the monarchy. Z. He's Z enemy. I don't know how convo. I had not read the previous arc. I hadn't read this at all, actually. This is my first time reading it. So,
okay.
So, right. You know, so I found the whole thing interesting. I had not read the previous arc, the lead up to this. You don't really need to.
No, and it's, there was Epic Illustrated before this, but Epic didn't exist as an imprint. It was just something Marvel was publishing.
Yeah. Well, there was a whole slew of magazine style comics in the 70s because that was adult and they could get around the comic book code. So they could do things like horror and, you know, violence. It's
like when EC changed to Mad and did it as a magazine format.
Exactly. So and Epic was part of that. Like I said, I hadn't read any of that, but he brings you up to speed pretty quickly.
He catches you up in by all accounts, like I some of the origin bits in here are basically covering the stuff that happened in the magazine format stories that were told previously.
Yeah, I actually went and read the Wikipedia summary of the previous story and I was like, yeah, this is all covered. I got it.
you know, I think that for the most part, there is eventually by the end, the monarchy is crumbled by the instrumentality. The instrumentality is set up finally as the big bad. Dread Star and company win like a decent amount of battles. They make some allies along the way.
They ally themselves with the TV station.
Right. And the commune, there's an interesting, the commune is an interesting concept. It's not really a commune in the way we think of it, but the commune is this, they're Switzerland.
Right.
Right. It's this
If Switzerland was a technocratic, you know, space media center.
Right.
That's the commune. Yeah.
Yeah. And also the center of all the technology.
Right. Right.
So the commune was started by like scientists, and it's this floating huge, it's a floating Death Star.
Essentially. Yeah.
Except not the Death Star. You know, and it's so they're neutral, so they sell technology to both the instrumentality and the monarchy. They control all the media. When we reach the end of this, once the monarchy falls, then the commune doesn't have the ability to maintain its neutrality anymore because they can't play both sides. At the end of it, it's set up so that Dreadstar and company are approaching the commune and trying to set up, a way to ally themselves with the commune. And of course, we don't see the end result of that at the end of this comic.
I think there's 64 issues total in this.
Right. And it bounced around, too. I think it ended up at, not Malibu, but...
No, it did go to Malibu eventually.
Okay, yeah, Malibu. And Image had it for like a brief period of time.
Mm-hmm. And First Comics had it.
First Comics.
Yeah, so it kind of was all over the place. It stayed fairly consistent, as I am led to believe.
Yeah, I mean, it was... The publication history is, you know, I mean, it was 60-some issues over 10, 12 years, so... Clearly, it wasn't. This wasn't a monthly comic. So I think, though, there are some odd things about this comic.
Yes, I agree. Well, it seems at times to be a bit unfocused. Ideas keep being brought up, but not really paid off. Unless they're paid off down the road, and I don't know about it, but. Yeah, do you get that feeling too, or?
Yeah, I mean, there is a little bit of the spaghetti on the wall, and one of the biggest issues I have with these comics is Plan M, and again, this is an idea that they introduce and is used briefly, then kind of disappears. I don't know if it comes back. So. One of the things they do is to counteract the instrumentality, the religious part of...
So the instrumentality, the church of the instrumentality, the way they are a religion. And so they have, they're not just citizens of the instrumentality, they're actually devotees. So that's how they have this, you know, kind of fanatical group that fights for them because it's a religion. Yeah.
So Plan M, so they refer to it numerous times in the first few comics, and it's in issue six is when we finally get what Plan M is.
And the cover is a giant Plan M, a giant M, which is fun.
So what happens is, like, so on in episode six, in previous issues, they've contacted the commune, which we've already discussed, and they set up like some airtime. They buy airtime,
which is what they needed to get the money for.
Right. Part of what they needed the money for. Yeah,
exactly.
And so what they do is they set themselves up as Dreadstar and company. They go to this planet called Teltoga.
Dreadstar and company. That's their corporate.
this planet Teltoga is being bombarded by the instrumentality. People are dying all over the place. It's a and so But what is also going on is there's a humanitarian issue on the ground because there's some disease that's spreading throughout the populace as well. So not only are they getting the hell bombed out of them, but they're also dying from some kind of virus. So Dreadstar and company have this serum that they have, like the cure for this disease.
Right.
And so they set up a PR event, essentially, where they show up to the planet to deliver this serum to the people. Very noble, very staged, very planned.
A vaccine, if you will.
It's a vaccine, yeah.
Yes.
This is where, as part of this PR stunt, someone has to take credit for the vaccine. And instead of them, any of the, you know, Odie or Willow or Dreadstar, any of those folks coming out and waving at the crowd saying, hey, I did this. Yay, me. I'm the best. They initiate Plan M, which is a Christ-like figure, Maxilon. They send this Christ-like figure who we haven't seen yet, but suddenly out of nowhere here, they have this, guy that they send out to greet the crowd. And he proceeds, while the communists filming this and sending it out to the entire galaxy, he proceeds to bring this message of love and peace and unity and what have you. To not only the people of Tel'Toga, but to the entire galaxy. And, you know, and everybody's like, oh, here it is. Oh, we need this religion. We need this guy. And he's telling the truth and he is bringing his message to us. And, ooh, this is great. So Maxilon does this big speech and the whole galaxy is wrapped with attention. And who is this guy? And the Lord High Papal, who's the head of the instrumentality, is like, who is this ID? I must know. So, you know, the guy goes back into the ship, and what we find out is that it's a robot that Dreadstar and the people have created for this specific purpose for propaganda. And so they're talking, like, after he does this and he go back aside and it's revealed that it's a robot, we have Dreadstar talking about what this propaganda is going to do and how they're going to use it. And one of the, you know, he said, at one point he says, and I'm quoting here, it's people need gods.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on to explain that they are also using subsonics when this Christ figure is speaking. Dreadstar, they're using subsonics to manipulate people's emotions.
Yeah. So subliminal messages, and he's programmed with ways, millions of religious ideas, so that right. He always says the right thing to the right person.
Yes.
And
that's messed up.
It is messed up.
Right?
Yeah. I think the idea of a robot messiah is a great idea myself, but but I think the idea of that is fascinating. Dreadstar, the mercenary, is going to counteract, you know, the Lord Papal, but counteract the Pope with his own homegrown messiah.
Yes, and manipulating the emotions.
It's a nice, I don't know, it's not cynical. It's more, what would you call it? You know, there's a message here.
Is there, though? I don't think Starlin presents this necessarily as a bad, I mean, I think he's these are the good guys.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess. I took it as this was just, I saw it as Dreadstar looking at it as this is just another weapon that he's using. And he's taking it in a cynical way. That the people need bread and circuses. They need their gods. So we're going to provide this for them so that we can end the war. A means to an end rather than, you know, something he truly believes in. And again, like you said, it's messed up.
Yeah, it's like we don't see the further. This is kind of dropped later on, at least in these 12 issues. I can't speak for the further portion of the series, but you know, it's introduced. There doesn't seem to be like any kind of moral or ethical issue with it. Starlin as the writer doesn't present this as with any kind of cautionary.
No, he doesn't. Now, at the end of this, at the end of the 12th issue that we read, they do, Dreadstar does mention that we need to get back to Plan M.
Right.
So, you know, that leads you to believe that it's going to come back again and play a major role. I think it's a fascinating idea. I mean, it's not morally good, not ethical. It's not right, but it's a really cool idea. He's such a, you know, he's white flowing robes and the long dark hair.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the symbolism is there.
Well, yeah, it's all, I mean, it's, you know, there's, this is not a subtle comic.
Oh, no.
In any shape or form, there's nothing subtle about it. There's, it's that, there's these weird moments. So there's this. I want to go back to, I feel like I just want to point out a couple weird things. There are probably other things you want to talk about as well. But in the second issue, I feel like, I know it sounds like we're, the second issue is Willow's origin, but we also have, it's also another heist issue where Dreadstar and company are
incorporated.
Dreadstar Inc. the heist in the second issue is they're going to this planet that's also like, it feels like every issue there's some planet being bombed.
Oh yeah, well it is a war, to be fair.
It's a war, it's a galaxy-wide war. So they go to this other planet, right, in the second issue, and why are they there? This planet is getting bombed, it's a dying planet, it's again another planet that's dying. They're there to loot the planet. Yeah, they're looting the planet for supplies. Wow.
Yeah.
Getting the bejesus bombed out of it. They're not there to help anybody. They're not there to save anybody. They're there just to like loot the planet for supplies.
Yeah.
They're like, well, this planet's going to get destroyed. So here we are.
Well, you know the old saying, steal from the poor to give to the rich. Because eventually they do give the money to the monarchy.
Yeah. It's like, and then in the third episode, or the I keep saying episode, in the third issue, which is also the third of the, like the, again, it's like the heist. The third one, they're on this planet to, what is it? Why are they there?
Well, no, they're a decoy on this. So
they're a decoy.
So Syzygy and Dreadstar are on this planet to draw the eyes of the high papal.
Right.
Of Lord Papal to them. While
right.
the background, Willow and Skeevo and Odie. And Odie can steal something.
Right. From the instrumentality, right?
Exactly.
So they're there on this planet. It's
not funny.
No, it's not. The planet is called Chicharo or Chicharo. And of course, the city that they're in is Chicano or Chicano. Or Chicago.
Yes.
It could be pronounced any of those ways. So they're there as a decoy. Well, Darklock and Dreadstar, being there as a decoy, ends up getting that whole city nuked.
Yeah, well, I was kind of surprised by this, as you can imagine, because I just assumed when the Lord Papal decides, you know, we need these guys dead, let's nuke the entire city, which is, you know, pretty extreme. And I thought, of course, you know, they were going to do something to, at the very end, to stop the bombs or defuse them or something. But nope. That whole city gets nuked and everyone dies.
Except for our titular hero and his buddy, because they see the bombs coming. And instead of shouting to everybody else, hey, get to the sewers, they just take themselves down to the sewer.
To be fair, it's Darklock that pulls Dreadstar down with him.
Right.
Yeah, that was a really dark moment, I thought. And it's not the first time. The very first issue, the whole point, the whole reason Odie's people are destroyed and wiped off the face of the planet was just because they were trying to get Dreadstar.
Yeah.
If I was Odie, I'd be a little pissed. I'd be like, maybe you should have left. Jackass.
it just feels like wherever Dreadstar goes, like lots of people, you know, and there doesn't, Dreadstar shows a little bit of remorse, but Darklock is just like, I don't feel bad about it at all.
But it's but once we find out towards the end of the end of these stories, Dreadstar was also, I mean, his previous life was destroying an entire galaxy. So, you know, what's a city being nuked to him?
This dude's just getting people killed left and right.
Exactly.
It's almost like he's the catalyst.
Yeah, it's almost like if you got rid of him, people would start living. Yeah, he's a, let's say, morally gray character.
But I'm not sure he's presented as such.
Yeah. Well, no, he's supposed to be this, you know, swashbuckling hero.
Right.
But really, he's just a catalyst for death.
Yeah,
it's pretty odd.
I may have stepped on the further discussion of the story by doing all this right now, but
yeah. Well, no, the whole thing ends with the fact that so the monarchy has a very weak king who's being manipulated by basically the Star Wars Imperial Guard,
you know,
Z enemy, who, as it turns out, we get all the backstory about Dreadstar being part of this. It's too convoluted to go into.
It's my God. Like I tried to take notes on his backstory, and I just was like, I'm not writing a novel to like.
Yeah. So essentially, in a previous life, there was a war in the Milky Way galaxy where we are, and
two competing. Sounds really familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah. Two competing superpowers, basically. When one of the superpowers is going to be found to win, in order to basically, they put the galaxy out of their misery by destroying everything.
Just destroy the entire galaxy instead of letting them be taken over by the Zygotians or the Zygodians.
Zygodians, which if I actually do live in the Milky Way, I would like a choice in that. Can I have a vote, please? I don't actually want to be euthanized because you don't like these guys. So that's it. And it turns out that one of the Zygodians has been posing as Z.
Right.
Z enemy, which is hilarious because they're so strong that they usually amputate their left arm. You know,
but this guy amputated his right arm.
Because he's left-handed. which, of course, makes him think that he's... Oh, sorry. It's so convoluted.
Well, it's the whole bit, like, to try to keep us guessing as to who Z is. And it's this idea that it's this... that they're really... That there's this big misdirection that we think that Z is this guy, Akhenaten.
Akhenaten.
Yeah. Right, who was one of the Orsorosians... As opposed to one of the Zygotians or Zygodians.
Is it Osiris? Like Osirans? Like,
well, that's what I'm,
Okay. I'm just thinking, because it's all Egyptian crap.
Right. Well, and I'm trying to, like, I had to write down the spelling.
Yeah. Yeah. It's off just enough that you don't really know what the pronunciation is.
Right.
Anywho.
So there's this attempt at a misdirection. We think that, Z is this guy Akhenaten or Akhenaten of the Orsorosians, the guy that decided to blow up the entire galaxy, right? But of course, it turns out it's not. And we are not able to figure that out on our own because his name is Z.
The Zygotian is named Z. Yeah, they're not really fast on the uptake.
No,
Dreadstar Incorporated. They really should get a intelligence branch. Get a little Dreadstar CIA going in here. Anyway, there's an epic sword battle. But again, Dreadstar, being on the home planet of the monarchy, which has a silly name as well, which I'm blanking on right now.
Jewel World,
that's what it is.
Jewel World.
I was about to call it Rainbow World, but totally different place. Because Dreadstar's there, they're bombing the planet. And more people die. Except Dreadstar, of course. Although he does lose his uniform and does need to get a new uniform.
Right. He does get a new uniform, which leads to some hilarious repartee and a, also some discussion about how tight it fits him in certain areas.
Maybe it'll look more balanced if I wear my gun holster. Wow.
Well, we do have to, like, just to take a quick break, I would like to mention that Jim Starlin loves to draw butts.
Yes, he does.
There are butts.
Yeah. He's an equal opportunity butt drawer.
Yes. No. We get everybody's butt in it. I mean, yes, they're wearing clothes, but they're not.
It's all tight fitting clothes.
Right.
You know,
everybody, but I mean, it's just like the butts are everywhere.
Yeah. There's one panel where Willow is just bending over to type something on a computer, and she's angled in such a way that the butt is facing us, and she's sort of sideways. It's like, it's a weird angle for you to be checking your email.
We're not in Greg Land territory, but...
No, but it is true. Jim Starlin does love butts, and he cannot lie.
And goatees.
And goatees. Butts and goatees. You can see a butt with a goatee.
Well, that's a different, again, Greg Land territory.
Yes. So anyway, all butts aside. Yeah. Like I said, I really enjoyed this. I had a lot of fun reading it.
Yeah, I think I feel like I'm pointing out all the flaws and not, you know, there's a lot going on in here. And I didn't want to go through 12 issues of exposition on plot. Because I'm not sure how much plot matters.
No, but again, he's creating a world. He's creating a mood and an atmosphere. Because it is very detailed. There's a lot going on. There's different cultures. The idea of the war being fought for hundreds of years over a planet that no one even knows why they were fighting for it anymore.
Is an interesting concept.
It's an interesting concept. There's a mineral that causes cancer and no one really knows why they're mining for it.
Right.
That
Catterlite.
Yeah, that gets paid off later down the line, not in this particular stories.
Right, but it is introduced. There's a, yeah.
Yeah, but there's, there's so much. The whole idea of the commune is a really interesting idea.
Right. There's a lot of, like, interesting politics that are going on. This is a lot, with all the kind of quibbles I just had, like, there's a lot of entertaining stuff in this. And, if you like, I mean, again, all butts aside, Jim Starlin draws some incredible, incredible space action sequences.
Oh, yeah. When it comes to the cosmic stuff, he's all over it.
He is the master of this.
Absolutely.
In so many ways. And this is an incredibly pretty comic to look at.
Oh, yeah. And some of the action in it, especially when you get to Odie's kind of cat-like reflexes and jumping over people. It looks good, and it's exciting,
and it's a big ass giant space epic,
right?
And it achieves that. It is an epic, and like you said, the world building, the origins that we get, that I think most of them are too convoluted for us to discuss right now. Although we get for everybody's except Skivo, I think we even get the Lord High.
I have to say the Lord High Papal, I think that backstory was unnecessary. I mean, I understand the thinking behind it to make it more relatable and more sympathetic and all that. But to me, it's kind of like when you take Darth Vader and you turn him into a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Sort of strips him of his menace a bit.
Yeah. You know, we find out that he's evil because he got rejected by a woman.
Well, he was also...
He's an incel.
Yeah. He also, watched his parents get killed in front of him, too. That happened.
Well, and that's, nobody likes that.
Yeah. But, it's sort of, I mean, this is also a guy who incinerates hundreds of people just because they're in the way.
Well, and nuked
an entire city. Exactly. So I don't really care how sympathetic you try to make his backstory. You know, he committed mass genocide.
Yeah,
it's kind of out the window at that point.
Over a 200-year span, it's like,
Yeah, exactly.
However long he's been. Time is a weird thing in this comic, right?
Yeah.
Like some people are living like forever. The like at some point we're told Dreadstar traveled for 1,000,000 years.
1,000,000 years.
1,000,000 years to go from the destroyed Milky Way to get to wherever, whatever galaxy he's in now.
Yeah.
It took 1,000,000 years.
But then even before that, there was 10,000 years.
Right.
You know, and yeah, so yeah, the time scales are pretty huge. Yeah.
And space is infinite, right? So, I mean.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. So this is all kind of good. And, you know, Starlin, he's fully aware of the silliness of this, I believe.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just first of all, he parodies the Hulk with Two-Ton.
And that's a very funny
yes.
That's a because it's Two-Ton smash, Two-Ton pulverize, Two-Ton kill, Two-Ton mangle, Two-Ton dismember. It's like,
yeah, exactly.
It's a very funny running gag.
And there's one point where Dreadstar Incorporated has to disguise themselves. So they disguise themselves as Star Wars characters. They look like Princess Leia and Luke and Han. Yeah. I mean it's Two-Ton. He's very self-aware, and
not to bring up a character. So Two-Ton is his name is spelled T-U-E-T-U-N, Two-Ton, yeah. And he's a running. There's also he's part of the instrumentality, and he's just sent in to smash and pulverize. So he shows up numerous times throughout the comic. I didn't mean to just introduce a character's name without any context.
There's a wonderful.
Actually ends up saving. Well, go ahead. What were you going
to say? I was just about to mention the same thing you are. There's an issue where it starts with this killer who's stalking his prey, and then it cuts to a different story. And you're kind of like, what the heck was that all about?
Right.
You know, but at the end, Two-Ton gets thrown off a building and lands on this killer. And everyone's like, oh, that poor guy. That was the sort of a punchline at the end of the...
Right. And it was a gag that took the entire issue to get to.
Right. I like that.
It's introduced on the first page and not seen again to the last page.
I kept wondering, like, when's that guy going to show up in this? Because it has nothing to do with him. And then there he is, crushed under Two-Ton. And I have to admit, there's in these issues, there's little cartoons of Archie Goodwin kind of introducing. Those are really fun.
Yeah, I remember those, like, because they were in, like, all of the Epic comics at the time. And it's Archie Goodwin is a much missed presence in comics in so many ways. But that was a lot of fun, is the rudimentary drawings of Archie Goodwin and in the costumes of the various folks from Dreadstar.
Yes, and there's one in particular where he's supposed to be revealed as he's the one who's Z under the mask.
Right.
And you know, the editorial, it's like, no, it's not you. You
know. And there's some funny, but they do some Fumetti
yes.
with Jim Starlin, who's always wearing a paper bag over his head.
Yes. Yeah, it's fun stuff. I miss that sort of tongue-in-cheek humor that comics used to have.
Yeah. And there was a backup. What is it? The Aldo Gurney and Farquaad.
Yes.
Gurney writes and gets like a brief little like backup story about some character named Aldo Gurney, who actually shows up in the background scenes a couple times. I don't know if you noticed that.
I didn't notice that actually.
When Starlin does like crowd scenes, you'll see this guy. It's this wizardy looking guy like in a bucket.
I have to go back and look at that.
Just seemingly apropos of nothing, there he is. He Bernie writes and has like a 5-6 page backup comic at some point in one of these. And you know, so that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. And again, I miss that sort of, you know, the way Stan Lee used to just ingratiate himself on every, you know, and just make you feel like you were part of the, you know, on the inside with all the writers and the artists.
Right, right.
Yeah. And Archie Goodwin kind of followed suit with that.
Yeah.
You don't really get that so much anymore.
You know, and I'm in at the end again, this is a really fun comic. It's a space epic. There's obviously we're bringing up some problems with it, but this is a comic from 1982. I mean, there's going to be goofy weird stuff.
Well, I think that has a lot to do with, you know, it's got to be dark. It's got to be for adults. So let's just kill people.
I think I think the Willow origin story is a little heavy-handed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's easy. So she's sexually abused, which is what her backstory is. And that's just, you know, it's easy and cheap. That's how you make something dark. You know, it's overused and it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But like I said before, she is a badass and she has agency and her character isn't based on that. I think that was just a cheap way to make things look, you know, adult.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. But that could be overlooked, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's, they move past it pretty quick and, you know, but they're using, it's the use of the childhood trauma as a trigger for
right
her powers is, it just, that's the one, and like all of this other stuff, like the Plan M and whatever, I can accept, and you know, it's kind of goofy and it's morally and ethically weird, but that part of it, I don't think it would, the Willow origin, I don't know would work if it was used today.
No, I don't think so. And the fact, the way it's written, Syzygy, Dark, is it Darklock? It's Darklock.
Darklock.
He, yeah, so Syzygy Darklock is, you know, kind of reading her mind and they're going through the story and he's not getting it.
And we all got it from the get-go.
Yeah, you got it from the very first page. It's like, come on, let's pick up the pace a little bit, buddy. You're supposed to be brilliant. And then he gets all shocked. It's like, yeah.
Her own father.
Oh my God. It's like, yeah, we got that. Yeah. Yeah. So it was just hammered home a little bit too heavy-handed.
Well, I think I only bring that up as a, I guess, potential trigger warning.
Yeah, but like we've been saying, overall, I think it's a lot of fun. I enjoyed reading it. I mean, this is actually something that I've wanted to read for a while, but you know, there's a lot of other things on the list. I never had a reason to go read Dreadstar.
And now you did.
I know. That's why this show is great for us.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the edit. And that's why this show is great for us.
For us. Yeah. Yeah, 'cause we actually are doing this just for ourselves. And if anyone else can get some entertainment out of it, good on you.
Yes.
But yeah, I guess, do we have any more to say?
I think, no, I mean, it's, if you're looking, if you're like, want that sort of weird early 80s sci-fi and you're like, you like Jim Starlin stuff, it's certainly worth, dredging up and reading through. I think there's a lot to be entertained by, stuff that we haven't gotten to. The plot can get pretty, like we said, pretty convoluted, but you know, there's a lot going on, and you know, obviously there's stuff that's made us laugh, but at the same time, I enjoyed reading it. Is it great comics? I don't know.
It's entertaining. Probably comics.
Not. It's entertaining and it's historical in that it's the first, you know, epic.
Right.
It launched like an imprint that I think was very important for a period of time.
Yes, I agree. And I'm actually intrigued to continue on. I probably will at some point. but thank you. Thanks, Brian, for recommending this. Because like I said, it's been on my list to read for quite a while. And now I've done it.
Now we have done it.
Yes.
Which brings us to your recommendation for next time around.
Yes. On an all new...
What would you like for us to read next, Paul?
Well, next time on an all new edition of The Collected Edition. Hang on a second here. A very special episode. We are going to be reading The Sentry. This is... Well, Sentry has Sentry. Gone on... Yeah, Sentry. I'm going to do this again. This time the right way. We are going to be reading Sentry by Paul Jenkins with art by Jay Lee. This was the introduction of the character. It was supposed to be a kind of one-off miniseries with a couple of one-shot crossovers. The Sentry has gone on to become a gone on in Marvel to various results, good and bad.
A character that people have feelings about.
Exactly. But I personally think this first introduction of the character, this kind of mini series, is quite good. Well, we'll see what Brian thinks. So
I didn't realize it was Jay Lee doing the art. That's definitely intriguing.
Yes. So it's Paul Jenkins.
Interior art by Jay Lee.
Yeah. So it's Paul Jenkins and Jay Lee, and the trade is the actual series itself is 5 issues, but then there's 5 crossovers, 5 one-shot crossovers. So it's 10 issues total, and that's all collected in a trade paperback called Sentry.
Ooh, that's convenient.
Yes, it is. So that's what we'll read next time.
All right.
All right. Well, again, thank you all for listening. We do appreciate it. Would love to hear your feedback. So send us an email at Collected Edition Podcast. No, that's not right at all. comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or send us a message on Twitter. Collected Ed Pod, that's Collected ED Pod. And I guess that's it. Till next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.